Gama Canto 3, Chapter 12, Creation of the Kumaras and Others, Text 5. Tandabhashe Swabhuputran Prajashrijata Putraka Tannaichan Moksha Dharmano Asudeva Parayana. Tan, unto the Kumaras, as above mentioned. Vibhashe, addressed. Swabuhu, Brahma, Putra, Putran, unto the sons. Rajaha, generations. Srijata, to create. Putrakaha, O my sons. Tat, that. Na, not. Aichan, desired. Moksha Dharmanaha, pledged to the principles of liberation. Vasudeva, the personality of Godhead. Parayanaha, who are so devoted. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. Brahma spoke to his sons after generating them. My dear sons, he said, now generate progeny. But due to their being attached to Vasudeva, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, they aimed at liberation, and therefore they expressed their unwillingness. Please repeat. Brahma spoke to his sons after generating them. My dear sons, he said, now generate progeny. But due to their being attached to Vasudeva, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, they aimed at liberation. And therefore they express their unwillingness. Purport. The four sons of Brahma, the Kumaras, declined to become family men, even on the request of their great father, Brahma. Those who are serious about gaining release from material bondage should not be entangled in the false relationship of family bondage. People may ask how the Kumaras could refuse the orders of Brahma, who was their father, and above all, the creator of the universe. The reply is that one who is Vasudeva Parayana, or seriously engaged in devotional service of the personality of Godhead, Vasudeva, need not care for any other obligation. It is enjoined in the Bhagavatam, 11th Canto, Chapter 5, Text 41. Devarshi bhutapta nrinam pitrinam, na kinkaro nayam rinicha rajan saratmanaya sharanam sharanyam gato mukundam paririchyakartam. Anyone who has completely given up all worldly relationships and has taken absolute shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord, who gives us salvation and who alone is fit to be taken shelter of, is no longer a debtor or a servant of anyone, including the demigods, forefathers, sages, other living entities, relatives, and members of human society. Thus there was nothing wrong in the acts of the Kumaras when they refused their great father's request that they become family men. Brahma spoke to his sons after generating them. My dear sons, he said, now generate progeny. But due to their being attached to Vasudeva, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, they aimed at liberation, and therefore they expressed their unwillingness. So this is an interesting verse that Prabhupada quoted in the purport. That a devotee is not obliged to anybody, it doesn't matter who they are, because they're attached to the lotus feet of Krishna. and of course in Bhagavad Gita also, Krishna ends up by stating the same thing, that you just sarvadharmam parityajya, throw away. Parityajya doesn't mean just kind of ignore it, it means actually reject it, give it up, push it away. Yeah, give up all other kinds of dharma and just surrender unto me. And I'll protect you from all sinful reactions. So, this gives a very great scope for misbehavior in the name of devotional service. We've experienced that practically in our progress as devotees in the Krishna consciousness movement. I think both individually and collectively we've seen sometimes some very liberal interpretations of this verse, that we're not obliged to anybody, we don't have to give anybody any attention, we don't have to take any instructions from anybody, we're not the servants of anybody but Krishna, and so we can do whatever we like and Krishna will protect us and everybody else is going to hell anyway. I remember we had a book distribution party in Australia in the mid-70s or late-70s. And that was basically their watchword. That everybody out there on the street are just a bunch of dirty meat-eating karmis. They're doing all kinds of sinful activities. And so we should just go out there and take them for whatever we can get. And that will be good for them. Yeah. So they would go out and they would use all kinds of methods for extracting money from the people on the street. And then they would drop a Bhagavatam in their lap just to let them know who it was that had ripped them off. And, you know, there was this kind of mood that we're devotees, we're better than anybody else because we've got Krishna on our side. Gott mit uns. Yeah, if you know that phrase. The German army had that written on their belts in the Second World War. Gott mit uns. God is with us. They forget, though, that sometimes God is with everybody else as well. And that becomes a problem. So who God actually is with and how one should, you know, behave in terms of being actually with God, that's a whole discussion. What is ethics in devotional life? Of course, sometimes if you misuse these principles, that a devotee is actually liberated from all material obligations. Still, even if that's a fact, it has to be understood how to properly apply it. If you don't apply it correctly in a society where others are governed by other standards of behavior and other kinds of dharma, then that can also still cause problems. Even if one individually may be faultless as a devotee in his intent, but still, if by his action he does something which is not acceptable to the community in which he lives, the material community in which he lives, then that may be counterproductive for the execution of his own devotional service. I can give a good example of this from my own personal experience. In 1973, myself and Korma Prabhu, the cook, we went off to Perth in Western Australia. We didn't have a temple then. We thought it would be nice to set something up. So off we went. And every day we would go out chanting at lunchtime, and then the rest of the time we'd be out selling books. So in our lunchtime Harinam, then we'd go around two or three of the main city blocks, and then we would end up in the main shopping street, Hay Street. It's a small place. Perth was not a big city at that time. And then we would stand for 10, 15, 20 minutes and just chant on the one spot there. So after a few weeks, the people that were in the shops in that street there became quite annoyed with us because, you know, we were standing in front of their shops and they felt that we were impeding their economic development. Yeah, because people would stop and watch us and then they would forget to go in the shops. Or, you know, they felt that we were causing an obstacle, or they just didn't like the chanting. It annoyed them. Why should we have these, you know, ragamuffins, gypsies, weirdos standing in front of our stores singing some, you know, strange words repetitively like a bunch of brainwashed zombies? So you get a lot of, you know, different variety of reactions there. But we didn't care because we were doing it for Krishna. Yeah, we were going to go out, and in the missionary spirit, Prabhupada told us that when you go out to preach, a lot of people won't like you. They won't like what you're doing. They'll resist it. But we have to do it anyway to save them, to help them. So we always had that spirit, and the intention was very nice. It was good. We were determined. So even when the lady came out of the store with a bucket of water and threw it over us to stop us from chanting, we wouldn't stop. Yeah. And then later on, the same person, she reported us to the police, seeing that she couldn't dissuade us by her own activities. She decided to get the police to come and do it. So, of course, we had this mentality, you know, it's us against the world. They're all karmis, they're all demons, they don't know anything. You know, we're out here trying to help them like this. So there was a kind of like that, you know, a few barriers up there, let's say. And so when the police came, then the police officer came over, we were chanting, he told us to stop. So we wouldn't stop. So then he stepped up and he, you know, very forcefully, Dashi Shiranamadava Kita, he very forcefully, you know, demanded that we stop. And he told us, he said, this is against the law. So I yelled back at him, being very passionate and, you know, full of my own self, of sense of self-righteousness. I yelled back, we don't care for your laws. We're following the laws of God. Like that. Anyway, so somehow or another, the policeman persuaded us to stop. I forget, I don't think he booked me at that time, but, you know, he somehow or another, you know, got us to stop. But still, every day we continued on. We wouldn't stop, and we were going out every day. So then, a few weeks later, we got this new rented house. And it was actually in a fairly kind of low-life area of the city. It was where all the nightclubs were, or just a little bit up the road. So anyway, it was a nice house, bungalow, and there were just three of us, myself. By that time, Korma had caught jaundice and gone back to Sydney. And we had one new devotee, Kripakara, and there was another devotee, Dwipayana. So there was just the three of us. So, you know, we literally had nothing except the money that we collected each day on the street. So we got this house, but there was nothing in it. And there weren't even any curtains, no furniture, nothing. And we were having, you know, our daily program. We would get up 3:30, you know, have our mangalarati in the main room. And there was a big window in the main room that looked out onto the pavement. And anybody that was going past, if they happened to be up at 4 o'clock or 4:30 in the morning, they would see us in there, you know, chanting and dancing. So it just happened that there was a gang of bikers that lived across the road. So they, you know, of course, being who they were and the kind of modes that they were in, didn't particularly like hearing the Hare Krishnas, you know, singing and dancing at 4:30 in the morning when they were just about to go to bed. So we didn't mind, we didn't care so much. But occasionally, the odd beer bottle would come flying over the road and land on the roof or smash on the front pavement there. But we still didn't mind, we just went on with our activities. And then one evening, maybe about 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, we woke up and there was all this noise going on, and there's motorcycles zooming up and down the road and all this yelling and shouting coming from across the road because the bikies were having a party. So they'd invited a few other groups, and you know, there was probably about 50 or 60 or who knows. They're all out there and they're all boozed up and they're all on their motorcycles racing up and down the street. And anybody that they happened to see walking along, they would jump on the motorcycle and go down the pavement. They weren't going on the road. They were going on the pathway, and they'd drive down the pathway and chase the people that were on the street there. Because it was a, you know, nightclub district, so there were a few people that were out at that hour, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning. Anyway, so we couldn't sleep because of the noise, so we just chanted our japa for a while, and then it was time for Mangal Aarti. Yeah, so I thought, no, well, we've got to have Mangal Aarti. Yeah. And so in we went into the front room. We put the light on so everybody could see us. And we started to chant. So naturally, all the bikers came around and they're looking through the window there and at these, you know, weirdos there in the pink bed sheets. And they're singing and dancing. So, you know, they all start, because they're all drunk, so they all start, you know, singing and dancing themselves for a while. Then when they got bored with that, they came in from the front gate. Then they started banging on the window. So we just kept on going on with our chanting and ignoring them. Then all of a sudden the lights went out, because the main electrical switch box was on the front veranda. So they just shut all the power off in the house. But they could still see in because of the light from the street lights. We just kept on chanting. So then they drifted away, and then about 5 or 10 minutes later, a few of them came back again, and they stood at the front wall and they start yelling, you know, stop it, you know, you're making too much noise, like this. We just kept on chanting. So then the next thing, bang, we hear this crash, and the whole front window starts, you know, vibrating like anything. They'd thrown a beer bottle at it. Somehow or another it didn't smash. We still didn't take the hint. And so we kept on chanting. And then all of a sudden, smash! The whole window shattered into thousands of pieces. A beer bottle comes smashing through, hits Kripa Kaur in the shoulder. And the whole room becomes covered with glass, and all the bikers are outside roaring with laughter. So at that point then we realized we'd better get out of here. So we went into the back rooms. So then I couldn't get out the front, so we didn't have a telephone. So I had to jump out the side window over the neighbor's fence. And by that time all the neighbors were up also because of the commotion. So I managed to get onto somebody's telephone. Actually, it was a local butcher's store. They were just nearby, but the guy let me use his phone. And I rang up the police. So then about an hour later, the police finally came. And then they took me and they insisted I had to go inside the house where the bikers were living and identify the people who had smashed the window. So, of course, I had no idea who had done it, but because I went into the house there, you know, naturally one or two of the inhabitants were quite inimical. Who's this guy? He's one of the guys that lives across the road. He's dobbed us into the police. So, anyway, we walked around, you know, there's bodies strewn everywhere, you know, drunks and, you know, whatever. We couldn't identify anybody. And then the fellow that was renting the house, he got quite abusive to the police, and he was yelling at them and telling them they didn't have a search warrant, they weren't allowed in his house, and he was telling me, I'm going to get you, you watch out, like this. Anyway, so the police arrested him, and they hauled him down to the police station and booked him for, you know, various offences, and they broke the party up and they sent all the bikers home. So by this time it was about 7 o'clock in the morning. So we continued on with our morning program. We were chanting japa. And then about half an hour later, this character that had been arrested, that lived in the house across the road, he comes strolling back down the road. They'd let him go. And he disappears into his house. And then a few minutes later, he comes walking across the road with his friend. They come in the front gate, and they come up to the front door. So the door was open, but there was a screen door. So he's on one side of the screen door, I'm on the other side. And then he starts yelling at me and cursing me. I won't use the words he used. And then he makes a grab for the door. So I slammed the door shut and locked it from the inside. So then the next thing I hear is smash, 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 like this. He's going around the house and he's kicked in every single window in the whole house. So again, I jump out the side door, out the side window, over the fence, into the neighbor's house. I ring up the cops. And then, again, they come about after half an hour. Every window in the whole house is smashed to pieces. And so the cops come and they ask, who's done it? The guy across the road. They go over, they arrest him a second time. So they put him in the car like this. Anyway, the irony of it was, and the point that I'm getting to, is that when the police car turned up, to arrest this young man, the policeman gets out the car, and who is it? It's the guy that came and tried to stop us chanting a few weeks before in the mall. He's the one that I yelled at, "We don't care for your laws, we follow the laws of God." And I could see when he looked at us, he thought, right, let's see you follow the laws of God right now, sonny. So he's the one that had to come and arrest the people that were attacking us. So anyway, my point is this, that we may be not obliged in so many different ways as devotees, if we're real devotees, that is, that's another topic. We may not be subject to the ordinary behavior that rules, ordinary materialistic living beings. Nevertheless, these kinds of principles have to be applied correctly and intelligently. Yeah, it's not that we can just come in and say, well, because we're devotees, we can do whatever we like, and everybody else is going to hell. Because when you're living in hell, then you may also be obliged, to suffer the same kinds of conditions that everybody else is, even if you're a devotee. Of course, as devotees, the verse is there in the Bhagavatam that those who are devotees, it doesn't matter whether they're living in heaven or in hell, because they are under Krishna's protection. Nevertheless, at the same time, as devotees, there are rules that govern our behavior. It's not that because we're not governed by the rules of ordinary man, that then we have no rules governing our behavior. Yeah, there are different levels of governance, and those, or dharma if you like, the activities of a living being. And according to the level of realization of the person, then there's a set of protocols or laws that person actually has to observe in order to make progress with their human form of life. That's why you've got Varnashram Dharma. But Varnashram Dharma is not a single set of rules that apply to everybody across the board. There are different rules that apply to Brahmanas, there are different rules that apply to Kshatriyas, different for Vaishyas, and different for Shudras. And then there are different rules even for those that are outside of the Varnashram system. And each class of man, understood by guna and karma, by the actions that he performs, by the characteristics that he has, then that person is expected to follow a certain standard of behavior. And if he violates that standard of behavior, then he actually incurs some simple reaction. So what a Shudra has to do is different from what a Brahmana has to do. If a Shudra tries to imitate the activities of a Brahmana, he becomes an offender, and then he's punished. And similarly, any one of the different sections of society, and then also Vana Ashram, the ashram side of things, the activities that govern the life of a brahmachari are different from those that govern the life of a grihastha. And they're different from that of a vanaprastha and different again from that of a sannyasi. And if one tries to imitate any of the other orders of society or ashrams and acts against his own nature, differently from his own guna and karma, then he becomes a transgressor and then he becomes punished, or he is punishable. So what dharma is, what is the right activity to be performed for any particular man, requires a lot of intelligence to understand. It's very, very difficult to ascertain actually what proper behavior is in any given time, place or circumstance. Even, of course, that's human beings, but then there are even other classes of living beings, and they also have their own dharmas to perform. Just like the demigods. The rules that govern the lives of demigods are different from those that rule the lives of human beings. So sometimes when you're reading Shastra, just like there's this story of Ganga Devi. She married Maharaj Shantanu. So he was a human being, and she's a demigod. So their actual rules of behavior are a little different. That's why, generally speaking, demigods don't mix with human beings. Yeah, because the different standard of behavior is required because of the different elevations of consciousness. So when Ganga Devi, she united with Shantanu Maharaj, she had 8 children. But every time one was born, she would take it and throw it in the river. And she had made a pact with Shantanu that when we get married, I will marry you, even though I'm a demigod and you're only an ordinary human being, but I will marry you under certain conditions, and if you follow them, I'll stay with you. And if you violate them, I will immediately leave. So one of the conditions was that whatever I do, you can never criticize. Yeah? Anything that I do, you, even if you don't agree with it, you can never criticize me. And if you do, finished. Relationship will be finished. So they had a son. So as soon as the son was born, she took the son and threw him in the river and he drowned. Shantanu Maharaj was shocked. This is not human behavior. But what could he say? He was so attached to his wife, he didn't want to, you know, destroy his relationship. So he tolerated it. It's called infanticide. A mother takes her own child and kills it. And then, not once, twice, 3 times, 4 times, 5 times, 6, 7 times, this happened. And each time, he had to button his lip and not say anything. But finally, on the 8th time, it was too much. And then he said, "What are you doing? Why are you taking? You've already drowned 7 of my sons. Give this latest one, the 8th child, at least an opportunity to live. Why are you doing this?" So then she said, "Okay, that's it. Now you broke the rule, I'm going. And I'm taking this child with me." But before she left, she explained what was really going on. And then she told the history of those children. That in their previous life, they were actually the 8 Vasus. And they had committed an offense against the sage Vasishtha by stealing away the Kamadhenu cow that he had in his ashram. He was out of the ashram, they got attached to the idea of having that cow for themselves, and so they stole it. And when he came back, he could understand by his mystic power who had done it, so he cursed them to take birth as human beings. Which, for personalities as elevated as the Vasus, is something like being cursed to take birth as a hog or a dog. Yeah? To take birth as a human being. So they were very mortified by that. Then they happened to meet Ganga Devi and they pleaded with her that, "Please do something to give us relief from this curse." And it just so happened that Ganga Devi herself was under another curse because of something that she had done wrong. And she also had to take birth of be in the society of human beings. So she very cleverly combined the two curses together. And they got some mitigation from Vasishtha Muni that they didn't have to live their full lives as human beings. They could just take a birth as a human being, and that would be sufficient to fulfill the conditions of the curse. So then it was decided then that Ganga would go to Earth. She would be the mother of the eight Vasus. And when they were born, she would then release them immediately after birth from that human form so that they could return to their position as the Vasus. But because the leader of the Vasus was the one who was caused all the mischief in the first place, he was not forgiven, and he was told, no, you have to live the full life of a human being. So accordingly then, Ganga became the wife of Shantanu Maharaj. When the child was born, she knew this is one of the Vasus, and the condition of the curse was that just the birth, but not living the full life. So then she took him and threw him in the river, and immediately he was liberated. He went back to his position as a Vasu. But to Maharaj Shantanu, he couldn't understand what was going on. He thought this is completely abominable. But for Ganga Devi, this was simply, you know, the enactment of an agreement that had been made in the heavenly planets between her and the Vasus and Vasishtha Muni. So for her, it was perfectly all right. In fact, she was doing a favor to that child by throwing him in the river and drowning him. Yeah. So anyway, then the eighth child, then he was the leader of the Vasus. He was the one that had to live a full life. And therefore, Maharaj Shantanu finally spoke. He finally said something. So that also must be the influence of the demigods, that now he has to say something in order to stop Ganga from drowning this one so that he can live his entire life as a human being. So Shantanu spoke. Ganga said, okay, that's it. Now my business here is finished. Goodbye. And this boy I'll take with me, but later on he'll come back to you. And then, of course, later on he did come back. Many years later, then Maharaj Shantanu happened to be walking along the riverside on the Ganga, and then he saw that the river had stopped flowing, and he thought this was very unusual. And then he saw that there was a very brilliant, effulgent youth who had, somehow or another, just with his bows and arrows, he had stopped the flow of the river Ganges. So he thought that was very wonderful, very powerful thing. And then he actually thought, I wonder if this is my son. And actually it was, Devabrata. He was the eighth child. So anyway, long story. But, of course, that child later on became Bhishma Dev. And Bhishma Dev, of course, was the key figure in the whole history of the Mahabharata, the development of the Kuru dynasty, and then, you know, leading up to the Battle of Kurukshetra. So Bhishma Dev was one of the main characters in that. So that's, you know, a purpose that was being served there in him taking his birth. And there's, you know, bigger purposes around why that Vasu had to take birth in a human family and become the great Bhishma Dev. You know, that's... So the point is that it's not very easy to understand what a person's doing and why they're doing it. You know, what is the nature behind those activities? So for Ganga Devi, her nature was a demigod. Very, very elevated personality. She could not be limited by the laws of ordinary human beings. But if an ordinary human being was to do the same thing, they would be immediately punishable. Just like 2 weeks ago, there's a story in America. Some man, he fell out with his wife. They argued. So what did he do? He took his three kids, he went on a bridge, and he threw them in the river. And they drowned. His own children. Very abominable. Why? Because he fell out with his wife and he wanted to hurt her. So the kids, you know, became the victims. So what can be said about that? Then, of course, he'll be locked up now probably for the rest of his life, you know, for killing his own children. But nobody attempted to lock up Ganga Devi. Shantanu was the king. He was the one who was supposed to keep law and order in the society that he was the leader of. But when his own wife threw his own children in the river, he didn't say anything. So, you know, one may read that, and of course if an ordinary person reads the Mahabharata, there are many, many stories in the Puranas of a similar nature to that. The activities of, you know, demigods. And if you take those as your examples, then the end result will be that there will be havoc in human society. You can't imitate that kind of behavior because the development of your consciousness is not as great. And therefore, there is another set of rules and regulations. So no one should cite Shastra, you know, as a means of avoiding the regular rules and regulations that govern the society in which he lives. Yeah. It's very important that one not rationalize one's misbehavior with a quote from Shastra. There's an old saying that even the devil can quote the Bible. In other words, you'll find all kinds of things in Shastra, and if you want to rationalize your behavior, you can find all kinds of things. Well, he did it. You know, Moses took his own son on the mountain and put him on a slab and was going to sacrifice him. I'm going to do the same thing. Yeah. No. It has to be very carefully understood what the proper ethics of behavior are for any particular kind of human being. So Dharma is very, very intricate. It's very difficult to understand. And one cannot simply take, as they say, one end of the chicken but not the other. Yeah? Arda kukuki, kukuti nyaya. Yeah? Arda means half. Kukuti means the chicken. Nyaya means logic. So arda kukuti nyaya means the logic of half a hen. And that logic is that here you have a hen, from one end the egg comes out. Yeah, so the egg is very nice for some people. And in the other end, yeah, you have to feed it. You have to put so many grains and things. It costs money, yeah, to feed these chickens. But you make money, you know, from the other end when you get the egg. So now, if you think, if I cut the chicken in half, right, chop off the head, I don't have to feed it anymore. And from the other end, I'll still get the egg, and I'll make money from that. That's ridiculous. But that's the kind of logic that sometimes people have. Half-end logic, that I'll take the bit that I like, and I'll dispense with the bit that I don't like. Yeah, the bit that I have to put some effort into, no, get rid of that, I don't like to do that. And the bit that gives me some pleasure and sense gratification, oh well, yeah, very welcome. So if we take Krishna's instruction, Sarvadharmam Parityajya, oh very nice, yeah, give up all forms of dharma, yeah, just give it all up, yeah. I don't have to do anything now, I'm not obliged. It says right here in the Bhagavatam that I have no obligations, I'm not the servant of anyone. Yeah, to hell with the pitcheries and the, you know, the forefathers and the family and the human society. I can do whatever I like. I'm not the servant of anyone. If you can give that interpretation, then you're in big trouble. That's misuse of Shastra. Yeah, give up all forms of dharma. But under what conditions can you do that? That's the question. And of course the answer is given. That you just surrender unto me, Krishna says. You surrender unto me. Who is it that can ignore, you know, the rules and regulations or the relationships that one has with one's superiors? Mukundam Pariricya Karatam. Those who have taken shelter at the lotus feet of Mukunda. They can do it. Vasudeva Parayana. Those who were very much devoted to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Kumaras, they could tell Lord Brahma, sorry, you want something, but we're not going to do it. At that point, it was practically unheard of. Lord Brahma was the creator of the universe. He's their father. So he must be actually respected and obeyed. But here's these little boys, very young, less than 6 years old. Kumara means less than 6 years old. So they're telling him, no, you want us to get entangled in material life, we're not doing it. Yeah? But why? Oh, so we can go off and enjoy and have sense gratification? Become what Prabhupada used to call a bachelor daddy? Yeah, everybody knows what a bachelor daddy is. Prabhupada coined that phrase to describe those disciples of his, the men who wanted to have sexual relationships with women but not take the responsibility of becoming a householder. A bachelor daddy. A bachelor means you're not married, and a daddy means you're doing that business. So Prabhupada coined that phrase. Yes, they want to be bachelor daddies. So the Kumaras were not saying that. That, no, we're not going to get entangled, you know, in having progeny, getting married, accepting so many wives. Oh, that's a big hassle. Yeah. It means that now we have to get a job. We have to feed them and clothe them and educate them and provide a home for them and get all entangled. That's not good. We don't want that. Okay, fair enough if you want to say that. If you have the right perspective and the right realization. Their realization was that moksha dharmano. Our dharma is moksha. We are aiming for release from this material world. We know we're not this body. We know we're not part of this material existence, even though, you know, we've just appeared in this material universe. They already knew this is all a false show. And they already had that determination within their heart not to get entangled in it. So they knew very well, Lord Brahma, he has to populate the universe, and he needs other living beings to help him to do that. They have to become, you know, the Prajapatis. Those who give forth all the other generations of different kinds of species of life in the universe. Like Maharaj Daksha. Yeah, he was also a son of Brahma. But he immediately accepted that responsibility. Yes, I'll get married. He had so many different wives. And through them, he propagated all the different species of the universe. He wasn't just giving birth to human beings or demigods. Snakes, birds, all different kinds of species. These are the Prajapatis, very, very powerful, amazing personalities. So, that's Daksha, he's a brother of the four Kumaras, but the four Kumaras weren't having anything of it. They were already at the stage of realizing that this material world is an entanglement. It's an illusory creation, and we don't want anything to do with it. So even though we're here now, our only business is to get out. So they refused that request of Lord Brahma, and they were right to do it because Vasudeva Parayana, they had a higher principle of activity, a higher principle of action. Not that they're just simply giving up one responsibility and then becoming irresponsible. It's not like that. Everybody has to be responsible at all stages of life. But the responsibility that one accepts is according to one's realization. So according to one's realization, one may accept any one of the varnas or the ashramas in human society. Or if one is not a human being, he may be born somewhere else, then he accepts another kind of responsibility. And if one is irresponsible, then there are agents within the universe that will enforce compliance. Just like if one's in human society, even in ordinary material society, there's so many laws, as we've already pointed out. And there's an agency there to enforce that law. And if one misbehaves or doesn't care for that law, then he has to be punished. That's natural, because if somebody is irresponsible and misbehaves, he causes a disturbance for all others that have to live with him in that society. So human society especially should be peaceful. Yeah? And dharma, the purpose of rule and regulation, of course, also cannot be blind. Yeah, we can argue, well, there's laws and rules and regulations in present-day human society. But then there's a question of, do those rules and regulations actually bring any benefit to the human beings that they're being applied to? There's the purpose of Dharma also. Dharma may mean the activity that one performs. And according to the realization that one has, he has to perform a kind of activity. But then also there has to be a purpose to that dharma, to that activity. There has to be a goal. That has to be understood. And if it's not properly understood, then that dharma also may be ultimately not beneficial. It may be what we would say irreligious. So it's very complex, knowing what to do and what not to do in any particular time, place and circumstance. And knowing how to apply the right kinds of rules and regulations, you know, to a particular kind of individual. So that requires a great deal of realization. Not just, you know, gyan, but vigyan. Gyan means, okay, the knowledge is there, it's in the shastra. The descriptions are given of the different kinds of behavioral activities. But how to apply them according to time, place and circumstance, that requires very, very great intelligence. And therefore we see, just like in Kali Yuga, there may be so many different, you know, activities that are prescribed in Shastra. Let's say the Manu Samhita. So in the Manu Samhita you'll find so many different rules and regulations. So how to apply them? Who was it? One of the associates of Lord Chaitanya, I just forget his name now. Anyways, one of the leading associates of Lord Chaitanya, he got us in a spot of bother. He was sprinkled with water by a Muslim. And so the other members of the Brahminical community that he lived in told him, now you're an outcast, you're rejected. So then he was distressed because he couldn't live according to the rules and regulations of the society at that time. The Brahminical society had interpreted their dharma in a particular way. And one of those interpretations was that if a person comes in contact, you know, with a malecha or a yavana, like a Muslim meat eater, then he was immediately rejected. He was no longer a brahmana. So who was it? Subhudiroy. So then he was perplexed what to do. So he went to some brahmanas, so they told him, yes, according to Manu Samhita, or Shastra, you have to drink boiling hot ghee. Because if you drink boiling hot ghee, what will happen to you? You will die, that's all. And that will rectify your, that will purify you. So then he thought, oh, how can I do that? So then he went to another set of brahmas and they said, no, you don't have to do that. That's not the right thing. So in this way, he just became confused. Because nobody could actually, you know, help him to purify his situation. Ultimately, of course, he went to Lord Chaitanya, and Lord Chaitanya told him, just go to Vrindavan and chant Hare Krishna. Now this is a good excuse. You've already been rejected by your society that you're living in, so take advantage of this. Go and retire to Vrindavan. And you live there peacefully, you chant the Hare Krishna mantra, you worship Krishna, and then you go back home, back to Godhead. So that was a good solution. So, how to interpret Dharma, how to understand what is the ultimate benefit of a living being, because that's what Dharma is for. It's meant to define our activities in such a way that we get proper benefit, yeah, from the expenditure of our human energy and our intelligence. How to get the best kind of benefit from this body that I've acquired, from the nature that I have acquired. So that's Dharma. And what the proper Dharma is, you have to go to a person who's qualified to understand it. And they give you, yes, this one, in your circumstance, this will be the best thing for you. So as far as the Vaishnava is concerned, there's one common panacea for all the problems of life. Yeah. Otherwise, if you get wrapped up like, you know, these Subhuti Roy, you go to this one, they say one thing. You go to that one, they say another thing. You go to another one, they say something else. No. Lord Chaitanya, he gave this one common panacea. All right, give up everything else and take shelter of Krishna. That's the ultimate instruction. Yes, you'll read in Shastra so many different standards and codes of behavior for different kinds of persons. But ultimately, everybody is a spirit soul. And their dharma, as Prabhupada pointed out, you ultimately understand dharma in its essence. What is the essence of dharma? To be a servant. That's all. To be a servant. Every living being, no matter what his situation, must serve. Now, where should that service go? So if you don't have a very high realization, your service will go to different levels of society. Human society, animal society, demigod society, but all the different kinds of societies that exist in this material universe, according to your realization, your serving propensity will be directed towards one of those or more of those kinds of societies. You're involved with them, so therefore you have to relate to them according to their requirements and according to your requirements. But if you have the ultimate realization that you're not this body, that you're not part of this material world, and that you are in fact a part and parcel of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, then your dharma becomes very, very clear. Yeah? You come to the ultimate platform of dharma, which is Sabadhamam Parityajya Mamikam Saranam Vraja. Just surrender to me. That's the trade-off. You can give up all the other kinds of dharma if you surrender to me. Yeah? You can ignore the demigods, you can ignore the forefathers, you can ignore your parents and human society if you are surrendering to Mukunda, the lotus feet of Mukunda. Yeah, you can tell even Lord Brahma, sorry, no. You can refuse his request if you're a Vasudev Parayana, but only on that condition. So that then is a very exalted situation. To be fully surrendered at every moment so that all one's dharma or activity is fully engaged at every single moment for the pleasure of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That's Vasudeva Parayana, Narayana Parayana, Kotishvati. Very, very rare position, Sudalabha. Yeah, this is mentioned. That those who are Narayana Parayana, yeah, they are very, very rare personalities in this material world. They're hardly to be found anywhere. This is in the sixth canto, it's mentioned there that when the description was there about Vritrasura, and you know, Vritrasura, he was a big demon, but he was chastising Indra and actually preaching to him, "You're so attached. Why are you materially attached? Just fight and die, that's all. Or fight and be successful. But you should just work for the pleasure of the Supreme Personality of Godhead." And this is a demon that's speaking. So it was a very big surprise. Sukadeva Goswami couldn't understand. Yeah, how is it this big demon, who are generally governed by the modes of passion and ignorance, how could he preach to the leader of the demigods about his proper dharma? So then he was told, he said, there are as many living beings in this universe as there are atoms. Just as many as the atoms there are as many living beings in this human in this universe. And out of those, very, very few of them become human beings, get a human form of life. There's so many forms of life. And out of those, very, very few of them become brahmanas. Out of those, very few of them become siddhas. And out of those, hardly any of them come to this position of taking shelter at the lotus feet of Krishna. Vasudeva or Narayana Parayana. Kotishvasvipi means out of many millions of siddhas, not just any living being, out of all the siddhas, hardly any of them become a Narayana Parayana. So this is a very, very exalted position, and it cannot be abused. We should not think that now that we're trying to become devotees, yeah, because I put tilak on and shave my head or put a sari on and a dot or whatever, you know, and I'm chanting a little japa every day. And we shouldn't think that that makes us a Narayana Parayana. Yeah, that now we're fully on this exalted platform. We're trying. But our behavior has to also be governed properly. It's not that now, you know, we've got the bead bag in our hand, we can do whatever we like. And then, actually, because in our heart, we have so many material desires and misconceptions that we continue to do all the nonsense activities that got us in this mess in the first place. Yeah, but now we just do it under the guise of being a devotee, you know, using the imagery of a devotee as some kind of a barrier, you know, to stop us from being obliged to follow the ordinary rules and regulations. That is not acceptable. So if one is a devotee, actually, it means, all right, yes, his only activity is to please Krishna. He's not obliged to anybody else, but he doesn't misbehave either. He may not be ruled by the behavior that governs ordinary men, but he doesn't misbehave towards any living being either. Therefore, the description is given in the Bhagavatam, Titikshava Karunika, yeah, that Ajatashatrava, he's a friend of all living beings. This is Sadhu. Shanta, he's very peaceful, he's completely in control of his senses and his mind. And Karunika, Prabhupada in his purport there, he says that this is the real symptom of a devotee, that he's very, very merciful to all other living beings, not just human beings, but any living being. A devotee is actually merciful and extends the mercy of the Supreme Lord to all of those persons. Ajatashatrava, nobody is his enemy. He's not envious of anybody. He doesn't see somebody else, oh, he's got a big car, I wish I had that. That's envy, immediately. Oh, why has he got a big house and I'm living in a shack? That's envy. A devotee has no such feelings within his heart. He's completely devoid, yeah, of any envy towards any living being. Rather, he's a well-wisher. Not only does he not desire what any other living being has, but he wants to give to those living beings something that they don't have, which is the shelter of the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord. Because he knows that that is the greatest treasure. And he'll actually go out of his way. He'll accept difficulties. To Tikshava, he has to be very tolerant. To be Karunika, you have to be very tolerant. Because sometimes people won't appreciate what you do as a preacher. Karunika means preaching, giving Krishna consciousness to others. So a devotee will actually not just not participate in ordinary behavior, but he'll go out of his way, he'll make some activity to try to raise those living beings to a higher position. And sometimes they won't appreciate that. Sometimes people are quite happy to do their materialistic activities, and they don't like to be told or reminded that this is not very beneficial for you. So they'll react in a very adverse way. So a devotee is even willing to put himself in a position where he's harmed, yeah, where he's attacked by other living beings, ignorant living beings, just so that he can actually do some good for them. So this is the actual exalted position of a devotee. It's not, you know, a cheap thing. So we have to remember that then when we're practicing our devotional activities, that we can't use verses like this as an excuse. Well, the four Kumaras, they told their father that they weren't going to do what he says. You know, if some child in a devotee family, if he turns around Or she turns around and tells her parents, well, the four Kumaras didn't do what Lord Brahma told them to do. I'm not going to go to school. No. You have to, you know, it depends. If you're as elevated as the four Kumaras, you can cite them as an example. And if you're not on the level of realization that they were on, don't. Yeah. So Dharma, anyway, then, is the activity which is performed, which is intrinsic to one's nature. And depending on your realization, then you'll figure out what your nature is. If you actually know that you're not this body, you're a spirit soul, then your dharma will, or your activity will, correspond to that realization. But if you actually think that you are this body, or you behave as if you are this body, if you have so many material propensities, you know, for fulfilling the gratification of the senses and mind and intellect, then you have to work according to that, and you can't claim another's position. Okay, so we'll finish at that point. Does anybody have any questions or comments? Yes, brother. You have a question? No. Loudly.
There are three stages of rules connected to bhakti. First is varnashram and dharma, where bhakti is secondary. You follow the rules of varnashram and dharma, but also a little bit of bhakti. And then there is varnashram and dharma, where bhakti is in the first place. And there is nirapeksha, where there is anything more.
What was that last bit? What was the last sentence? I understand there's different levels of you saying in varnashram dharma. What was the last comment that you made? So he's saying that there are different levels or performances of varnashram dharma according to one's realization. There are different stages. The final stage is nirapeksha, where everything else is given up in favor of bhakti. But in the stages where one's bhakti is not as prominent, then one's behavior is governed by, you know, varnashram dharma, principles of varnashram dharma. So therefore, Prabhupada said in our society he wanted to see varnashram introduced, actually here in Mayapur on February the 14th in 1977. He gave us a lot of instructions about that. He said that in ISKCON we should have varnashram dharma. Because, of course, he said as devotees, yes, all right, we can say we're transcendental and it's not necessary for us. He said, but the problem is that they're not even chanting their 16 rounds. He was talking about his own disciples. So he said, yes, you can say that, oh, I'm initiated, we're devotees. But he said that many of them, they're not even chanting their 16 rounds. In other words, they do need then to be governed by, you know, some kind of varnashram system, which will regulate their activities. And that's what the point that I was making before. You can't say, oh, just because I've got a beat bag, you know, or I look like a devotee, that means that I am actually a devotee. Yeah. So according to one's realization, then one's activities should be enacted. And that means somebody has to be there to give instructions. All right, you work like this, you work like that, and chant. And then gradually when you come to the position when you're fully purified, yeah, when your only business is just chanting, yeah, when you can chant 24 hours a day, Kirtaniya, Kirtaniya Sadar Hari, then you can do any kind of service. But when you're in a condition, more conditioned state, when you're in that stage of mixed devotional service which is influenced by ignorance or ignorance and passion or by goodness, then there's specific activities which should be performed. Yeah? And then by doing that, but with the addition of bhakti, then gradually you come to this Vasudeva Parayana stage. And then you're free to do whatever you like. And you won't be affected by it. As Chitraketu was not affected by taking birth in the, you know, as a demon. He acquired the nature of a demon. But he was such an exalted devotee that it didn't affect his own state of consciousness. He remembered, you know, what his real position was as a servant of the Supreme Lord, even though he was, you know, occupying this body of this ferocious demon, and he had to fight with Indra, who is one of the leading devotees in the universe. But he didn't forget it. That's the nature of devotional service. So sometimes, you know, we have to externally work in a certain way, but internally we should always remember that we have to do this for Krishna. Then that keeps us nicely situated, it keeps order in society that we live in, and at the same time we continue to make progress spiritually. Yes, Guru. Yes. He's asking, what about the situation with the Kumaras, that apparently they were Vasudeva Parayana as soon as they were born, and then at the time that they were asked, we hear about the story of how they moved from being impersonalists to being transcendentalists, or, you know, personalists. So in what order did that happen? Is that the question? Here it says that they're Vasudeva Parayana right from the very beginning, but then we read about how there was a point which they moved from being impersonalist to being personalist. So how can an impersonalist be a Vasudeva Parayana? That's a good question. Does anybody have any insights on that one? I mean, I can speculate about it, but I'd rather not. Not something. When I was reading this, that it did occur to me, and I thought I might get away with not having to answer that question. I have to do more research. I don't want to say anything without being certain about it, because it would just be speculation. It's something that somebody could look up. Yeah. Well, this particular verse says that when they refused the order, it was because they're Vasudeva Parayana. When they refused the order, and that means we presume that that was right after they were born. Now, when did they go, you know, to the Vaikuntha Lokas? When did they get that higher realization of the devotional service of the Lord and move from being impersonalist to personalist? That's the question, and that's not really answered there.
When the kid is born, you look at his chart and you say he's a Rani, he's a Kshatriya. And you can understand this example similarly, that they were supposed to be devoted, but they were just, you know, just a few minutes to become completely...
All right, so there's a bit of speculation. Anybody else got one? He's saying, well, when you see a person's chart, horoscope, you can understand what they're going to be in the future, yeah, even though at the present moment they may not be that. So in a similar way, the four Kumaras could be understood that they were going to become devotees, even if they weren't at that very moment. Anyway, that's one speculation.
Millions of years after.
Anyway, it's something somebody could look up and see if you can find out more information about the appearance of the four Kumaras and how it occurs. Do they reappear every day of Brahma? That's one question. Yeah, so that, you know, maybe they became Vasudeva Parayana in a previous day of Brahma. Yeah, and then on the next day when they reappeared, it needs to be looked up. That's what occurred to me, that maybe it was in some previous kalpa. But check it, find something. We should finish, it's very late. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.
You were saying